I don't know what they have to say. It makes no difference anyway. Whatever it is, I'm against it. No matter what it is or who commenced it, I'm against it.
Hello, all. Welcome back to another episode of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. I've been going decently heavy on the guest train recently. I've been very blessed to have some really amazing co-hosts bringing insightful perspectives on. And we're going to continue to bring on great minds to dialogue about the issues surrounding these cases, but today I'm flying solo. I do want to say thank you to everyone on the show who's left me feedback and commented regarding the First Amendment Church and State episode that I did with Andrew Heaton. I found that a fair number of listeners staunchly disagree with me, but have been engaging in a really enlightening and civil discussion about the merits of each side, which is really what I was hoping at the end of the day this show would encourage. So I'm truly happy that people are listening, voicing their opinions, and adding to the general discourse on these issues. Even those who have disagreed with me have done so always respectfully and with a genuine eye towards learning and promoting a reasonable dialogue. The subject of today's case needs very little introducing. He gained notoriety as a fiercely aggressive lawyer who was media savvy and unafraid to take on really prominent targets. He has represented NBA players, musicians, rape victims, porn stars, and huge corporations. He's taken shots at sitting presidents and at Supreme Court nominees. In this case, we're going to talk extortion. We're going to talk conspiracy. We're going to talk threats. We're going to talk fraud. And we're going to talk interstate commerce clause. This is the United States versus Michael Avenatti.
Your proposition may be good, but let's have one thing understood. Whatever it is, I am against it.
Regardless of whether you have an interest in the legal system, criminal justice, or celebrity lawyers, it was virtually impossible to avoid hearing about Michael Avenatti during the years of the Trump presidency. In fact, I had to engage in a real internal debate to decide just which Avenatti case to cover. And I'm not referring to any of the cases where he was the lawyer representing a client. I'm referring specifically to cases in which he was the defendant, because he has had multiple. And even now, they may not still all be over. But for those of you who spent the years 2016 through 2020 under a rock, Michael Avenatti was a prominent lawyer based in California who's known to be an assertive bully of an attorney. Already pretty well known for representing celebrity clients, he rose to national prominence when he took on porn star Stephanie Clifford, who used the stage name Stormy Daniels, and began a very public feud with President Trump over an alleged affair Trump had with Daniels and then paid to keep quiet. Chances are that you also remember subsequent to this very high-profile shouting match with President Trump, he was arrested for defrauding his adult entertainer client and represented himself at the trial, where he was accused of identity theft, fraud, and stealing some of her book proceeds. Now, there's a chance that we could cover that case in the future, as I'm always fascinated when lawyers represent themselves at trial. I think that it's really a crazy phenomenon and deserves to be studied. But in this case, we turn to another instance where Avenatti flew a little too close to the sun and found himself on the business end of a federal prosecution. But first, let's take a quick step back. Avenatti was born February 16, 1971, in Sacramento, California, though much of his childhood was spent in Colorado, Utah, and then Missouri. After 1 year at St. Louis University, Avenatti transferred to my alma mater, the University of Pennsylvania, where he graduated with a political science degree in 1996. After graduating from UPenn, he was accepted to the Knight School program at George Washington Law School, and he graduated in 2000 with high honors. In 2003, GW Law School established the Michael Avenatti Award for Excellence in Pretrial and Trial Advocacy after he made several significant donations to the school. Avenatti was a very political person. In both college and in law school, he worked for a media firm run by Rahm Emanuel, doing political opposition research. Emanuel would later become the White House Chief of Staff under President Barack Obama. Also, while in law school, Avenatti worked on around 150 different political campaigns in 42 states. After graduating law school, Avenatti returned to California, where, after passing the bar, he got a job with the prestigious national law firm O'Melveny & Myers. He worked closely with a man named Daniel Petroselli, who represented the family of Ron Goldman in their lawsuit against O.J. Simpson, as well as representing Christina Aguilera and some members of the band The Eagles. With his profile rising, he eventually left O'Melveny & Myers after a few years and joined a firm called Green, Broylett & Wheeler, where he continued to handle high-profile and huge settlement cases, including one where he sued the television show The Apprentice, including producers Mark Burnett and Donald Trump. In 2007, he partnered with a man named Michael Egan to form Egan Avenatti LLP, a law firm which very recently went bankrupt. There really isn't enough time in this podcast to go through all of the high-profile cases Avenatti handled while practicing in California, but he was routinely negotiating multi-million dollar settlements or winning massive awards at jury trials. Then, in 2018, Avenatti went from well-known in the California legal circles to a national figure when he filed a lawsuit on behalf of adult film actress Stephanie Clifford, aka Stormy Daniels, seeking to invalidate a 2016 non-disclosure agreement she signed relating to an alleged affair with now-President Trump. The NDA had been negotiated while Trump was running for president, and one would assume he did not want the details of an affair with an adult film star coming out while he was campaigning for the religious rights vote. Avenatti also filed a defamation suit on Clifford's behalf against Trump later on in 2018. Now, that case was dismissed, and she was ordered to pay Trump's legal fees. At that point, she went public and claimed that Avenatti filed the lawsuit against her wishes. At the same time, Avenatti was making public media appearances vowing to appeal the dismissal. The relationship with Stormy Daniels soured, and she eventually replaced him with attorney Clark Brewster. It later came out that Avenatti was being investigated by the Department of Justice for fraud and embezzlement, and Avenatti was sentenced on June 2nd, 2022, just a few months prior to this recording, to 4 years in prison for appropriating approximately $300,000 from Clifford during the time of his representation of her. Some people may also remember Avenatti for that brief moment in September 2018 when Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh was going through confirmation hearings. It would be difficult to forget the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford during that confirmation when she accused Kavanaugh of sexual assault when they were in high school. Now, Avenatti didn't represent Miss Ford. Avenatti represented a woman named Julie Swetnick, who is a second woman who offered a declaration under oath that Kavanaugh drank a lot and was physically aggressive towards women. Swetnick, through Avenatti, would claim that she was the victim of gang rape at a party that Kavanaugh also attended, and Avenatti provided names of people at that party. But none of the names he provided actually panned out, as the individuals listed all denied knowing Swetnick. But Avenatti then offered another declaration, this one from an anonymous woman, claiming that she was corroborating Swetnick's story and that she had seen Kavanaugh spike punch bowls and engage in abusive behavior towards women. This then prompted the anonymous source to come forward publicly in October 2018 and announce that she had not actually seen Kavanaugh pour alcohol in any punch, nor had she ever seen him act abusively towards anyone. After that, the Swetnick accusation fizzled. But again, those are not the cases we are here to discuss. So let's get into it. In March 2019, Avenatti's profile was sky high. He was the go-to lawyer for major high-stakes litigation. Now, there's a thing that happens to some successful lawyers, and I imagine it could happen to successful people in any field. Anyone can succumb to this. you start to feel invincible. You start to believe that everything you do is going to work out exactly the way that you want. At some point, it stops being about making money and starts being about power, control, and bending other people to your will. In March 2019, Avenatti's public persona flaunted wealth. He generally had his pick of whatever cases he wanted to do and could tailor his representation to sure winners with big paydays. He was a good lawyer with a good reputation as a fighter and a hard worker, and he had a great record of success. To the world, he was at the pinnacle of the profession. But at some point, he began to lose that voice that we all have inside us that warns us when we're taking risks that are too great. He began to believe that people would do what he said just because he said it, regardless of what it might mean for them. Avenatti agreed to represent a man by the name of Gary Franklin. Franklin was the director of a basketball program and was also a coach in a California AAU league. AAU stands for Amateur Athletic Union and features some independent high school basketball leagues under the program. The AAU leagues are quite competitive. Skill level is very high, and many of the top AAU players go on to play at prestigious college basketball programs, and some ultimately make it even to the NBA. The league that Franklin directed had been sponsored by Nike to the tune of $72,000 a year. But Nike had elected not to renew their contract. In response to learning that Nike wouldn't be continuing its fairly lucrative affiliation with his program, Franklin told Avenatti that some Nike employees were illegally paying high school players or their families and then hiding the payments. The payments were made to steer high schoolers toward certain colleges that Nike was friendly with the hopes that these players could further be steered, ideally one day, to NBA contracts and Nike endorsements. Now, this came on the heels of a 2017 federal case involving Adidas paying AAU players and directing them to certain collegiate programs which Adidas favored. I'm not going to get into this case too much because I actually represented one of the individuals in that case, and I don't talk about my former clients without their permission, and I haven't spoken to this individual client for some years. But for our purposes, with the Avenatti case, it's important to know that Adidas took a pretty big reputational and economic hit for this. It really hurt the company. It cost them money and reputational damage, and it sent shockwaves through the sports industry, especially with the AAU and collegiate leagues. So Avenatti sees an opportunity here. He knows that Nike does not want to take a hit like Adidas just took. This type of misconduct will bring a lot of unwarranted attention. Then if the company is found to be paying players to take certain actions, it will cost them in more ways than just money. Avenatti calls a lawyer friend of his. And if you followed this story in early 2019, chances are you know who it is already. It's another very prominent attorney who has represented a lot of big names. In this case, he is only ever listed on any government filings as co-conspirator one. So in fairness, I will not give his name here. I'm going to call him MG. But he's appeared in other episodes of this very podcast. So if you dig deep enough, or if you simply employ some light Googling, I'm sure you can ascertain who it is. Avenatti, based in California, calls MG and asks to use his New York office for a meeting with Nike lawyers. MG calls representatives from Nike's legal department and arranges a meeting in his New York office on March 19th, 2019. In this New York meeting are Avenatti, MG, some of MG's staff, and Nike lawyers. Avenatti tells the Nike lawyers that he represents the director slash coach who has recently learned that Nike is not renewing its sponsorship contract with his program. He further stated that he knew that Nike employees were paying some of the players in this league, and he even named a few individual players who he believed had been paid according to the coach. And he indicated that he knew of more. Avenatti then tells Nike that he's planning to hold a big press conference and make this information public. Avenatti is well aware of how this situation hurt the Adidas brand, and he's clearly trying to use this as leverage over Nike. But wait, Avenatti says, there is a way for Nike to avoid this massive headache. They can avoid the press conference and the massive reputational hit and all the consequences it would bring, and all Nike has to do is to pay his client, Gary Franklin, $1.5 million to settle any potential claims and absolve any liability concerning Nike's refusal to renew his sponsorship contract. Oh, and one more small thing. Nike would also have to hire Avenatti and MG to conduct an internal audit regarding these claims. And they would identify who the bad actors are and report to Nike so that Nike would not have to deal with any outside sources regarding this. Nike could then self-report to the Department of Justice if they so choose. According to Avenatti, this would make Nike look good, like they're trying to root out their own rogue bad actors, and they're committed to doing the right thing. It's a win-win. Now, for his and MG's services, Avenatti indicated that something in the realm of $15 to $25 million would be appropriate. This conversation and this meeting took place right at the beginning of March Madness, the huge annual college basketball tournament in which Nike invests heavily in advertising and would really not appreciate a massive negative press right in the middle of, right at the beginning of. Additionally, Nike was about to hold its quarterly earnings call within the next few days. A big press conference and the resulting negative media attention could have a huge impact on that earnings call as well. So Avenatti's feeling pretty good. He felt like he was poised to make a lot of money by forcing Nike to do exactly what he wanted them to do. Avenatti told the lawyers from Nike that he wanted an answer immediately. In response, they said they would need to speak to management, but would get back to him quickly, and left the meeting. Nike's lawyers spoke later that day with MG, requesting a little bit of time, and were told that an answer needed to be given within 2 days. Nike representatives immediately contacted the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, which covers Manhattan, where the meeting took place. They informed the Department of Justice about the conversation and indicated that Avenatti was attempting to extort them into paying him millions of dollars. From this point onward, all communications between Nike's attorneys and Avenatti were surreptitiously recorded by law enforcement. On March 20th, the day after the initial meeting, there was a telephone call where Nike lawyers asked Avenatti for some additional time to think about his offer. And this set Avenatti off. He got angry. He claimed he didn't know why they would need extra time to think this over. And he reiterated that his client would need to get $1.5 million and that he and MG would have to do the internal investigation. Now, the Nike lawyer's position, as had been dictated to them by law enforcement agents, was that the $1.5 million to Avenatti's client was not going to be a deal breaker. They were okay with that. But they thought that his price for conducting an internal investigation was extremely high. Now, keep in mind that neither Avenatti nor MG had ever been hired to conduct an internal investigation before, much less for a massive multinational company like Nike. They would be coming in with no experience whatsoever. Now, the following is a quote from a transcript made of part of the phone call. And I apologize for the language, but this is what Avenatti stated. "I'm not fucking around with this, and I'm not continuing to play games. You guys know enough now to know you've got a serious problem, and it's worth more in exposure to me to just blow the lid on this thing. A few million dollars doesn't move the needle for me. I'm just being really frank with you. So if that's what's being contemplated, then let's just say it was good to meet you, and we're done. And I'll proceed with my press conference tomorrow. I'm not fucking around with this thing anymore. So if you guys think that you know we're going to negotiate $1.5 million and you're going to hire us to do an internal investigation, but it's just going to be capped at $3 million or $5 million or $7 million, like, let's just be done then. and I'll go and I'll take $10 billion off your client's market cap, but I'm not fucking around. Now, after the conversation, Nike continued to express some hesitation, and Avenatti agreed to have another in-person meeting on March 21st. But he indicated in no uncertain terms that he expected to walk out of that meeting with an answer and would hold a press conference that same day if Nike declined. So let's take a quick beat and make sure we have a full sense of what has happened thus far. We have the first communication, March 12th, 2019. MG lets Nike know that something serious needs to be discussed. He sets up a meeting in person in Manhattan, New York. And he tells Nike that Avenatti will be conducting the meeting. No details are really shared in this call at all, except that it's serious. The meeting takes place on March 19th, 2019. In this meeting, Avenatti comes right out by saying he is damaging information about Nike, and in exchange for not going public with it, he has two demands. A certain client of his, Gary Franklin, who feels aggrieved that Nike didn't renew a sponsorship, who's going to get $1.5 million for, well, not arguing about his sponsorship not getting renewed. And Avenatti and MG were going to get something in the vicinity of $20 million to conduct what would amount to a sham internal investigation of Nike regarding some employees paying AAU players for influence. The initial meeting may not have had the feel of a true extortion scheme, even if it had the language. According to a source in the room for the meeting, the voices were fairly calm. It was matter of a fact. Tempers weren't flaring, and the atmosphere felt very much like a negotiation as opposed to true coercion. Now, this doesn't mean that the content of the message wasn't pure extortion, but the tenor and the tone changed when Avenatti didn't immediately get the yes answer he wanted. And in the subsequent phone call, he lost his temper. He was irate. He basically threw a hissy fit that Nike didn't immediately cave into his demands. Most accounts of this have MG saying and doing very little, which is why I believe he was not arrested and charged with Avenatti. The transcripts I've read of the calls and the meetings that came out at trial are almost exclusively Avenatti talking. MG was apparently in and out of the meetings and didn't say much while he was present. So March 21st, 2019 comes around. And there's another meeting at MG's office in New York City. Law enforcement has told Nike's lawyers to convey to Avenatti that they'll consent to the $1.5 million to Gary Franklin, the AAU program director, but they want more information about the internal investigation. Avenatti responded at the meeting that he expected that he and MG would be immediately given a $12 million retainer. And that their billings would be guaranteed between 15 and 25 million. He said that he would cap it at 25 million and that Nike would not be expected to go farther than that. Very generous. Avenatti again tried to convince Nike that the internal investigation would benefit Nike by allowing them to self-report misconduct at their own discretion. Nike lawyers, again at the direction of law enforcement, then asked Avenatti what they could do to simply be rid of the whole scenario. Rather than have an internal investigation hanging over their heads, essentially saying they wanted to potentially end the charade without having to hire Avenatti and MG and have them in the company. Avenatti responded to this by saying that for $22.5 million, he and MG would give total confidentiality about the whole situation. They would ride off into the sunset. After giving this ultimatum, he stated the following. Again, this is from a transcript of the meeting that was recorded. Avenatti says, "I just want to share with you what's going to happen if we don't reach a resolution. As soon as this becomes public, I am going to receive calls from all over the country, from parents and coaches and friends and all kinds of people. This is what always happens. And they are going to say, I've got an email or a text message or now... 90% of that is going to be bullshit, because it's always bullshit 90% of the time. Always. Whether it's R. Kelly or Trump, the list goes on and on. But 10% of it is actually going to be true. And then what's going to happen is that this is going to snowball. And every time we get more information, that's going to be the Washington Post, the New York Times, ESPN, a press conference, and the company will die. Well, not die, but they're going to incur cut after cut after cut after cut. And that's what's going to happen as soon as this thing becomes public. March 21st, 2019 was a Thursday. Nike's lawyers convinced Avenatti that they would have a final deal on Monday. Avenatti was very unhappy, but reluctantly agreed that by Monday, March 25th, 2019, they would have a final signed deal in place. About 2 hours after the meeting ended, Avenatti sent a veiled threat to Nike by tweeting out an article about the Adidas executive who was sentenced to 9 months in prison for similar conduct. And with this added text, "Something tells me that we have not reached the end of this scandal. It is likely far, far broader than imagined." On Sunday, March 24th, 2019, agents from the FBI got an emergency arrest warrant from a magistrate judge. And on March 25th, 2019, while Michael Avenatti was walking into Nike offices for the proposed meeting, he was taken into custody. He was arrested roughly 15 minutes after he had announced a press conference claiming he would reveal a scandal about Nike involving high school and college basketball players. The announcement came after he was informed that law enforcement had approached AAU program director Gary Franklin. Avenatti was initially charged with 4 counts. Conspiracy to transmit interstate communications with intention to extort, conspiracy to commit extortion, transmission of interstate communications with intent to extort, and finally, extortion. Let's quickly look at these charges and then discuss the arguments which came up at Avenatti's very public and heavily covered trial. And if you've listened to past episodes of this show, I've gone over the difference between a substantive crime and a conspiracy charge before, but just in case, let's do a very quick recap. A substantive charge, something like extortion or transmission of communications with intent to extort, requires the defendant to actually commit the substantive act. The crime has not been completed unless and until the defendant does the particular thing which is described and prohibited in the statute itself. The two substantive charges here are closely related, but that they're separate in that they have slightly different elements which comprise the crime. The crime of extortion is defined in Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 1951, to occur when an individual or entity obstructs, delays, or affects commerce or the movement of any article or commodity in commerce by robbery of extortion or attempts to do so. Extortion is then further defined as obtaining property from another with consent induced by wrongful use of actual or threatened force, violence, or fear, or under color of official right. This crime carries a maximum potential penalty of 20 years in prison. Now let's look quickly at the communications charge found in Title 18 of the United States Code under Section 875, Subsection D, which states that whoever, with intent to extort from any person, firm, association, or corporation any money or thing of value, transmits in interstate or foreign commerce any communication containing any threat to injure the property or reputation of the addressee. And that is punishable by up to 2 years and potentially a fine. So extortion is the physical act of obstructing or attempting to obstruct commerce by taking or attempting to take property from another through the use of force or fear. And the second charge is essentially using an interstate communication to threaten the injury to the reputation of a person or a corporation for extortionate purposes. Slightly different, but similar. And they have vastly different potential sentences. But for these two substantive charges, Avenatti cannot be found guilty unless the government can establish beyond a reasonable doubt that he actually did these particular things. It's also important to note the interstate aspect of this. Under the United States Constitution, Congress, who has the authority of drafting federal criminal statutes, also has the authority to regulate interstate commerce. Accordingly, Congress can criminalize actions which would interfere with interstate commerce. If the communication at issue dealt solely with intrastate commerce, then it may violate that state's penal law, but it would not trigger the federal statute. And that includes the methodology of the communication. Things like using the mail or even communicating via cell phone have been determined to be interstate communications because, whether intentional or not, they are using mechanisms that apply to different states. So a cell phone call, even if you're calling your neighbor who lives right next to you, can implicate interstate communications because of the way that the messages bounce around. So the basis for congressional authority to ban both the communications at issue here is that they are using the commerce power to ensure that interstate commerce is proceeding without criminal obstruction. Now let's briefly turn again to conspiracy. Avenatti was charged with the two substantive crimes we just mentioned and also conspiracy to commit both of those crimes. When a person is charged with conspiracy, it's always conspiracy to do something. There is no generalized, you are in a conspiracy charge. So in this case, it was conspiracy to extort and a conspiracy to send the offending interstate communications. The conspiracy itself is the crime in this situation. Conspiracy is defined as an agreement between two or more people to accomplish an illegal goal. But in order for it to be successfully prosecuted, it must be shown that the conspirator has taken one or more what are called overt acts in furtherance of that illegal goal. They actually have to take a step towards accomplishing that goal. The accomplishment of the object of the conspiracy, which would be doing the substantive crime, is not necessary to convict a person of conspiracy. Let's take a quick example to kind of flush this out. If Kate and Andrew decide to rob a bank, and they get together in their basement, they discuss the robbery, they pick a day, and they agree that on next Tuesday, they will enter the bank, demand money, and escape in their getaway minivan, then they have agreed to commit an illegal act, bank robbery. But the plan itself is not an overt act in furtherance of the bank robbery. Let's suppose further now that Andrew and Kate contact their friend Snark, who they know can obtain unregistered firearms. They think that bringing guns to the bank robbery will help them pull it off. So they meet Snark on Monday, the day before they've planned to rob the bank, and they each buy a gun from Snark. They tell Snark about their plans to rob the bank and explain that this is why they want the guns. Now let's further suppose that Snark is working with law enforcement. He contacts the FBI and tells them about Andrew and Kate's plan. The FBI springs into action and arrests Andrew and Kate on Monday evening. Andrew and Kate cannot be convicted of the substantive crime of bank robbery. They haven't actually robbed any banks. They can, however, be convicted of conspiracy to rob the bank because the two of them entered into an agreement to commit an illegal act, robbing the bank, and then took an overt act to further the goal of robbing the bank. They obtained guns. Okay, so that concludes our refresher on substantive crimes and conspiracy. Let's talk Avenatti trial. After being arrested, Avenatti was freed on bail, as it was determined that he was not a flight risk or a danger to the community to the extent that remand in jail would be justified. Those are the two criteria that are considered when a judge decides whether or not to set bail, to remand, or just to release somebody. Avenatti hired brothers Scott and Howard Srebnick to lead his defense team. Representing Avenatti must have been a truly difficult task. I've had my share of narcissistic, egotistical clients in somewhat high-profile cases, The advice I give them is almost always the exact same. Do not, under any circumstances, post on social media about your case or about the charges. Do not talk publicly about the U.S. Attorney's Office, provoke them, or insult them. Do not make any public statements about the facts regarding the incident. And absolutely, under no circumstances are you to sit down for an interview with a major news network to discuss the details leading up to why you were arrested. But some clients literally cannot help themselves. Avenatti went on CBS and CNBC and claimed that he never extorted Nike, that he was simply zealously representing a client, and that at all times he wanted Nike to do the right thing and offered his assistance in helping them do it. He denied making overt threats and claimed that he merely acted as a lawyer taking a tough negotiating stance for his client, Gary Franklin. You can watch these interviews on YouTube. They are not hard to find. Because of this, Avenatti locked himself into that story, whether the Srebrenics wanted him to or not. I do not know whether Avenatti discussed his public statements with his lawyers first. I have to assume he did. As a lawyer, he knew the consequences of doing this, and I just think they probably couldn't talk him out of it. I will say that there are times when it's important to get an alternative set of facts out when a case is being judged first in the media. But that is almost never effectively done by having the defendant, him or herself, being interviewed. Typically, the attorney will make a public statement or a press release or maybe an interview on the client's behalf. If the defendant, him or herself, makes the statements, they can be used against the defendant if he or she testifies at trial and says anything different. If the attorney says it, it cannot be used in that way. Avenatti gave these public statements while he was out on bail. But in January of 2020, weeks before his trial was supposed to begin, the other cases Avenatti was charged in, specifically the Stormy Daniels fraud case, finally caught up with him. Prosecutors contacted the court, and the Honorable Judge Paul Gardefee agreed that Avenatti had been continuing to engage in criminal activity while out on bail. So Judge Gardefee revoked it. Avenatti was put in jail pending the outcome of his trial. Matthew Podolsky was the lead prosecutor in the case. The trial started January 27th, 2020, and lasted approximately 2 weeks. Immediately prior to the trial, the prosecution slimmed down the charges to 3 counts. Now, this is decently common and occurs when either the prosecutor wants to shed some of the more tenuous counts because they think it hurts their overall presentation, or they think the interests of justice are best served by focusing on specific conduct that's easier to prove. There's a number of different reasons that this might happen. In this case, they settled on the substantive crimes of transmission of interstate communications with the intent to extort, attempted extortion, and honest services wire fraud. Now, we've covered the first two already, but honest services wire fraud is what happens when a person has a duty to another individual, as one does when one takes on the representation of another as an attorney, and when the defendant acts in a way that breaches that relationship and damages the client, who has the right to expect the attorney's honest services. In this case, prosecutors claim that Gary Franklin, the AAU program director and Avenatti's client, had a right to Avenatti's honest services. That is, for Avenatti to pursue Franklin's interests to the best of his abilities, and that Avenatti used the confidential information provided by Franklin to further himself at the expense of Franklin's interest. The prosecution's core case was fairly direct. They had the recordings, which were played for the jury, and they had Franklin's testimony himself. At trial, it came out that the relationship between Avenatti and Franklin was a little looser than originally perceived based on Avenatti's public statements. Franklin did contact Avenatti, upset about the loss of his $72,000 Nike sponsorship. He informed Avenatti about the payments made to the players, and Avenatti did indicate that he would try and turn that into a six-figure payday for Franklin. That's all true. Avenatti did not, however, seem to ever indicate that he planned to threaten Nike, or that he planned to try and use this information to get himself or MG involved in the situation in any way. In fact, MG was never brought up at all, nor was any sort of Nike internal investigation. The prosecution team also alleged that Avenatti was approximately $11 million in debt, and that his hyper-rich public persona was a sham, and that he desperately needed this payday to dig himself out of a self-made financial hole. And this narrative was simple. It was smooth. Avenatti had motive to try to extort this money because he was in massive debt. He had the means through conversations with Gary Franklin. He thought he could leverage Nike's fears based on what happened to Adidas into a massive payday and then refuel his lavish lifestyle. And he had the opportunity through meetings and phone calls with Nike lawyers. The evidence of the recordings of the meetings and phone calls was extremely powerful, and combined with Gary Franklin's testimony about the limits of what he actually thought Avenatti was doing, it put Avenatti in a pretty shady light. Now, there were other witnesses that testified in this trial, one of which was Jeffrey Auerbach. Auerbach was a friend of Franklin who had long worked as an executive in the entertainment and sports industry. He was involved in a number of conversations between Avenatti and Franklin and corroborated Franklin's account that Franklin had no idea that Avenatti was planning to do anything more than try and negotiate a claim on Franklin's behalf. Auerbach also testified that the tactic taken by Avenatti was completely contrary to what would have been in Franklin's best interest and served only to benefit Avenatti himself. Auerbach and Franklin both testified that they never wanted a press conference to highlight Nike making payments to players. They never wanted to go public at all, because it would actually be very detrimental to the AAU league itself, and as director of that league, Franklin wanted to avoid that at all costs. Podolsky also called Avenatti's office manager, Judy Renier, to testify that Avenatti's law firm had been evicted from their office space in Newport Beach, California, and that the staff had been working from home since March of 2019, but that Avenatti seemed to believe he had a way to get them a new space. Avenatti did not take the stand in his own defense, and in fact, his defense team did not put on a single witness. They introduced some items from Avenatti's briefcase at the time he was arrested, mostly articles concerning the Adidas prosecution, and then the defense rested. Scott and Howard Srebnick split the defense summation. They jointly argued what Avenatti had been saying in his public statements, and they tried to point this out to the best of their abilities through every witness that they could at the trial. Avenatti claimed that he was representing Gary Franklin, that he was trying to negotiate a favorable deal based on a perceived claim, the cancellation of the sponsorship contract. Avenatti further claimed that he was acting as an aggressive attorney, and that conversations like the ones that took place between himself and Nike's lawyers happen all the time in the high-pressure world of huge settlements and major corporate malfeasance. Avenatti's claim was that extortion did not take place here because Avenatti was engaging in a good-faith negotiation typical in legal cases. Scott Srebnick claimed that Avenatti had never intended to keep Franklin, his client, in the dark about anything and had every intention to explain fully everything that was happening, and that he planned to actually secure Franklin $1.5 million, which was $500,000 more than Franklin had initially wanted. Scott Srebnick also claimed that things were moving so quickly it would have been impossible to update Franklin about every minor development. Avenatti produced texts showing that both Franklin and Auerbach had agreed to give Avenatti discretion to take an aggressive stance when negotiating with Nike and encouraged him to do whatever he could to get Franklin a big payday. He argued that this, with the money he believed he was obtaining for Franklin, proved that he was not acting in any way contrary to Franklin's interest. In fact, quite the opposite. The Shrebniks also asserted that Avenatti had always maintained that Nike would do the right thing at the end of the day, conduct an investigation into wrongdoing, and self-report to tell the U.S. Attorney's Office how they had internally handled the situation. This was a negotiation. Avenatti's lawyers admitted that he took an aggressive stance, but claimed that this was just two lawyer teams jockeying for a position in a tough negotiation, and that does not make it illegal. The jury deliberated for around 3 days before convicting Avenatti of transmission of interstate communications with intent to extort, attempted extortion, and honest services wire fraud. Convicted of everything. For this, Avenatti was ultimately sentenced to 30 months, or 2.5 years, in prison. Now, Avenatti was facing multiple other charges in other jurisdictions. But that is how the Nike alleged extortion case came to a close. In summation, there is a term of art in the legal community called blustering. Blustering is loosely defined as using force or bullying with swaggering threats. It's an aggressive overreach of one's position to try and get the best outcome you can. Blustering in the legal profession is usually not illegal, but obviously there are limits. The problem is that the lines are not always crystal clear, and sometimes who the person is affects whether their actions are over the line or not. For those listeners who actually follow sports, you can think of this as how if you're LeBron James or Michael Jordan, you're a little less likely to get called for traveling. For those of you who don't like sports, you can think of it as how certain celebrities can get away with saying or even doing certain things that if you or I did it, would get us canceled or maybe even arrested. There is an upper echelon of society which enjoys a bit of the benefit of the doubt, a smidgen of gray area where the line gets a little thinner to accommodate someone's toe getting closer and closer to it. The rules are supposed to apply to everyone, but certain people get a little leeway that others might not enjoy. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that LeBron and Michael never got called for traveling. They certainly did. And celebrities like J.K. Rowling have taken a lot of heat for certain public statements that people deem offensive. No one gets away with anything and everything, as much as some people want to believe that it's possible. Avenatti's defense was that he was blustering, not extorting, not overtly threatening, blustering. He had information, he could share it. In his estimation, he was not demanding Nike do anything illegal, and he was not saying that he would do anything illegal. He was leveraging information to squeeze out a favorable settlement in an aggressive way. His position was not that if Nike did not pay him, that he would fabricate claims. He wasn't claiming he would commit a crime if Nike refused to agree to his terms. But the question is, does that matter? Should we examine this claim of extortion differently if the ultimatum doesn't ultimately involve a criminal act? Is Avenatti telling Nike that they have to pay him $15 to $25 million and employ him to engage in an internal investigation different than kidnapping an executive's child and demanding they do something with the company in exchange for the release? Now, to be clear, kidnapping is obviously also a crime, and I'm separating out any other underlying crimes just to focus on looking at whether or not there's a difference in the extortion. Does the existence of another crime have bearing on whether or not an extortionate act took place? Avenatti's argument was that it does matter, that this was all above board, and thus it was not extortion. I have two thoughts on this. First, I want to go back to the charge itself. Because in Avenatti's case, the charge of attempted extortion was the attempt to obtain money from Nike with the quote-unquote consent of Nike, but where that consent would be caused or induced by the wrongful use of fear of economic or reputational harm to Nike. That's the charge. So as the statute puts it, and as the court explained it to the jury, it simply does not matter if the actions taken or threatened by the defendant were illegal. It is sufficient if the jury were to conclude that the defendant wrongfully invoked fear of economic and/or reputational harm. By Avenatti's own recorded statements, his leverage was timing. He knew that if he acted on or around March 25th, 2019, it would coincide with March Madness, the collegiate basketball tournament, as well as right around the time of Nike's earnings call. That would cause massive reputation and/or economic harm, and that was the point. My second thought has to do with Avenatti's claim that his engagement in negotiations was done in good faith. Now, good faith can be a sticky concept, and in some close calls, I've seen some people err on the side of giving the actor the benefit of the doubt while others see deception or fraud. But in this case, I don't think Avenatti's actions can really be genuinely argued to take place in good faith on his client's behalf. And the reason for that is the total walkaway number. Law enforcement instructed Nike's lawyers to tell Avenatti that they would consider paying him just to completely go away. No internal investigation, nothing. And Avenatti said he would ride off into the sunset and Nike would be free and clear for $22.5 million. This all but proves that Avenatti is not trying to work out a win for Nike and a win for himself. He's willing to take his bribe and walk away. But Paul, I hear some of you thinking out loud, doesn't this type of thing happen all the time in the legal industry? One party approaches the other and says, for a settlement, we won't file a suit. And the two parties agree to terms and sign a non-disclosure agreement. Doesn't this happen every day? The answer is absolutely. That scenario happens every day. But that's not what happened here. This isn't the aggrieved party getting a settlement payout in exchange for releasing a party opponent from liability for a potential wrong. This is the lawyer overtly saying that he, who has no legal claim based on Nike's actions, wants $22.5 million or he will do his absolute best to inflict massive economic and/or reputational harm. At this point, it's clear Avenatti is not terribly concerned about Gary Franklin or what's in his best interest. Avenatti is out for his own payday. Michael Avenatti had a legal and ethical responsibility to act on Gary Franklin's behalf by virtue of taking him on as a client. He completely abdicated that when he attempted to orchestrate a massive shakedown on Nike. In doing so, he torched his client, and he tried to use confidential information provided by his client for his own personal windfall. To me, the jury got this one spot on. That's not even taking into account the myriad other fraud convictions Avenatti has incurred since this situation. He was convicted of fraud and identity theft with respect to the Stormy Daniels incident. In addition to that, he has faced federal charges for defrauding a Mississippi bank, for embezzling funds from a client named Hassan Whiteside, who's an NBA player. And then more charges followed in California, accusing Avenatti of stealing client funds to purchase a $5 million private jet. The list goes on and on and on. Michael Avenatti should be viewed as a cautionary tale for not just lawyers, but anyone who rises to the top of their industry and truly starts to believe the hype around them, that they're invincible. Being an attorney is, at base, a client-centered job if you're not working in public interest. It's something we have to remember every day. When you take on the responsibility of acting as a representative for someone, you are agreeing to put their interests first. There is no room to push for side deals to enrich yourself at their expense. Perhaps Avenatti was desperate for money, and this was the only way to get out of debt that he saw. Or maybe he was just greedy and saw a quick opportunity to try and make $20 million. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter. So this concludes the explanation of perhaps the most famous courtroom battle on Michael Avenatti's long list of legal troubles. I hope you walk away from this with a sense of what extortion is, what his argument was, and why the jury rejected his position. And if you want to reach out to me with your position, you can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod or find me on Instagram at insummation. You can visit the show's website at insummation.com and leave comments there. Or you can always look me up the old-fashioned way at my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. You can leave me feedback, ask questions, tell me where you agree or disagree with me, request a topic or a case to cover, or even ask a general law question that's been burning inside of you. I want to say thanks again to everyone who has reached out to date, and there were certainly a lot of you after the last episode. And I also want to say thank you to everyone who listens to the show. If this is your first time or you're new to the program, please feel free to subscribe and rate the show to help other people find it. Also, please check out the rest of the catalog. As always, a very special thank you to Eric Stipe for doing the audio editing for this episode. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.
And even when you've changed it or condensed it, I'm against it.